Can you tell me a story?
Sure. Once upon a time, a mom needed a new car.
Was she brave?
She was tired, mostly. But she went to Carvana.com and found a great car at a great price. No secret treasure map required.
Did she have to fight a dragon?
Nope. She bought it 100% online. From her bed, actually.
Was it scary?
Honey, it was as unscary as car buying could be.
Did the car have a sunroof?
It did, actually.
Okay, good story.
Car buying you'll want to tell stories about. Buy your car today on
Carvana.
Delivery fees may apply.
Hey, sweetie, your mother showed me this Carvana thing for selling the car. I'm going to give it a try. Wish me luck. Me again. I put in the license plate. It gave me an offer. Unbelievable. Okay, I accepted the offer. They're picking it up Tuesday from the driveway. I haven't even left my chair. It's done. The car is gone. I'm holding a check. Anyway, Carvana, give it a whirl. Love ya.
So good, you'll want to leave a voicemail about it. Sell your car today on
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Hello and welcome to Alchemy 101, the show that explores all avenues of transformation and aims to offer some useful nuggets that can support us in living in line with nature in a way that's true to our nature. No matter how contrary that might seem, just like this nightingale, the bird that sings out in the dark. I'm JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and I am so glad that you could join me today. Now, how is 2023 for you so far? Maybe you made a whole bunch of resolutions and maybe you're beginning to stress because you're not keeping to them. Well, stay tuned because mind and body coach Barbara Kerr has some useful tips for you later. But first, the link between stress and the brain with someone I'm always happy to welcome to the show. Professor James Goodwin is Director of Science and Research Impact at the Brain Health Network, an organisation set up to inspire and educate people on ways to keep their brains healthy. He's one of the world's foremost experts on brain health and the author of Supercharge Your Brain, a book that's a must read if you're looking to keep your brain in good shape. With so many people suffering from stress right now, I asked Professor Goodwin to give us some insights. We started off talking about happiness, as I'd seen a table showing that the Finnish are the happiest nation in the world, and I was curious as to his take on why that might be.
Because of the quality of their life and the balance they have between individual responsibility and accountability and help from the state. And if you've ever been to Finland, and I've only been there once.
Never have. No. Love to go.
Yes. I found it a very conducive environment in which to be, along with Denmark. Denmark also rates fairly high in the happiness stakes. Players, economically, are on the list, I think, of the top 30, but we're in the middle. We're nowhere near the top, like the UK, the United States, Western Europe. They're all in a middle position in that happiness table.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the list here. It's 13 for the United Kingdom. The 13th, I think, is on this list, and the USA, 18th.
So the pursuit of happiness in the United States has probably not worked out as well as they wanted or here. And there are a lot of reasons for that. And it's not just related to income. Income is a factor in being happy. Science, for what it's worth, people are most happy at $75,000 a year, which is $50,000.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So money does come into it then?
Money does come into it, yes.
Yeah.
And if you're earning that or more, it doesn't apparently increase your happiness. And psychologists will also tell you that if you're on that £50,000 a year and you're unhappy, it might be because you're spending it badly. And this goes back to an experiment they did in Vancouver when they gave people $100 and told them to go and spend it as they liked. And then they rated them on how they spent it and how happy they felt. Those who spent it on themselves were the least happy. Those who spent it on others were the most. So there's a social dimension of whether or not we feel comfortable with our fellow human beings that contributes towards our happiness. There's also another question that's asked is being married a recipe for happiness. And predictably, it turns out that it's who you're married to makes the big difference. And whether or not you have children, there are a lot of factors which go towards happiness. Now, this brings to mind a great experiment. JJ, you and your listeners can make up their mind whether or not they would have taken part in this experiment, because it's absolutely brilliant. This was called Track Your Happiness by Harvard University, reported in 2010. And they gave a huge number of people all around the world, can't remember the exact number, but it was a powerful study. They gave them an app called, predictably, Track Your Happiness, on the basis that they could be phoned up at any hour of the day or night and be asked to say what they were doing and give it a score out of 1 to 100 on how happy they felt.
I think that would stress me out.
You want to know the results?
Yes, please. Yeah, tell us the results.
In first place, unsurprisingly, was sexual activity. So all those who had their app call them or buzz away by the side of the bed and who answered it, they were having sex at the time, gave it 90 out of 100. Can you imagine the green to this experiment? It was astonishing.
Absolutely.
The number two activity was exercise. So people who were exercising said score 75 out of 100 for happiness. Right. Do you know what got the lowest score?
No, tell me.
Self-care chores. Showering, bathing, doing your hair. For anybody, doing their makeup, if you wear makeup, choosing what clothes to wear. Do you know what I mean? All these, getting ready for work in the morning.
Wow, that's daily fascinating.
Care, daily personal chores got the lowest score. 15 was the average score for that.
Yeah, this is very fascinating. But you're an expert in brain health, and this is connected. And I know in your book, Supercharge Your Brain, you talk about sex as being one of the aspects of keeping your brain healthy. But that's a fascinating result. But there are other things at play here as well. I'm amazed that doing these self-care chores are the things that people found the least pleasurable.
Yeah, it's astonishing. Now, how is happiness related to brain health? Well, there are three aspects of brain health which are supremely important. Number one is our thinking skills. How well are we doing in how we think? Can we remember okay? Is our working memory good? Are we still sharp at making decisions? Can we calculate risk? Can we work out the solution to problems? All these higher intellectual skills are very important part of brain health. The second one is, how well are we doing with other people? How well are we interacting? Now, the reason for that is we are eminently social animals. Social cognition, the capacity to relate to others, is embedded in our brain, and it's been there for over 1.5 million years because it was a survival skill. The only reason that humans are where we are in terms of our relationship to the animal kingdom is because we work together as a group. Individually, we're not that good. And an experiment that was done between a group of American and German scientists, and they compared human infants of about 2 years of age with chimpanzee infants. I'm not sure what the chronological age of those was, but at the same stage of development. Now, in terms of exploring the environment and their physical prowess, the chimps were holding their own with the humans. In fact, they were slightly ahead. But in terms of social activity, they were nowhere. Even at 2 years of age, little children followed leaders, worked as a group, made a plan, formed relationships, broke relationships. Social interaction was everything to them, and they were hugely capable at it. And the third element, which is brings us back to happiness, is emotional regulation. We have a balance of negative and positive emotions arising in the brain, deep in the brain, which are immensely powerful, and these have to be balanced. So you've got positive ones like feeling of elation, joy, happiness. And then we've got negative ones like despair, repugnance, fear, anger. The negative side. Now, they're both necessary. if you feel depressed or lonely, they are essential emotions to get you out of a fix. If there's something awful in the environment, like it's extremely cold, or you've got pain, the emotional responses of that will get you out of that fix. That's what they're designed for. And by and large, the brain seeks pleasure. We're back to the Dalai Lama. The main thrust of human existence is to pursue happiness.
And there's a chemical aspect to it as well, though, isn't there? So you're talking about emotions and such like. But there are chemicals like serotonin and GABA, G-A-B-A, GABA, which also influence how we feel. Talk to us a little bit more about that.
Yes, there is a biochemical basis for emotions. It's not the only explanation of why we feel like we do. In fact, TikTok overdid it recently by talking about have a low dopamine day to avoid highs and lows. And a feature writer from a major newspaper asked me to comment on this, along with another professor. And we both gave it the heave-ho. You can't explain your highs and lows throughout the day simply on the basis of the chemicals in your brain. But they are hugely important. And again, they form into these two classes. You've got those hormones which give you a great sense of well-being and those hormones which are more negative. So you have, for example, as you mentioned, serotonin, which is actually formed in the gut by the microbes down there. So all your listeners, look after your gut health, because those babies down there are producing pharmaceuticals which travel in the bloodstream to the brain and make you feel good. So you stress out your bugs, you stress out your brain. If the gut isn't producing serotonin, your moods are going to be unstable. It makes you feel happier and calmer. It can also, serotonin excess can also kill you. And I only discovered this recently, actually watching a program on forensic medicine.
Wow.
And, a drug user, the drugs that he was using interacted with serotonin in the brain. It's called serotonin syndrome. But serotonin is vastly important. Dopamine is as well. I mean, dopamine, the release of that, 40,000 dopamine cells in the brain, largely in the deep in the brain, in the limbic system, compared to 86 billion. But this chemical they produce is extraordinarily useful. It's not just part of the reward and pleasure system, although it makes us feel good. It's necessary for motor control, for example, smooth control of our bodily movements and our posture, our bodily stability. So. And then GABA, as you say, gabaraminobutyric acid, GABA, G-A-B-A. That actually is a great calming transmitter substance. It reduces the activity of our brain cells. It puts relaxation up. It reduces strain, and it calms us down. So those are the positive ones. The more negative ones, adrenaline is a huge driver of fight or flight. It's an alarm signal within the brain to produce survival behavior. And on top of that, there are dynorphins. Now, these produce within us disgust, discomfort. I mentioned repugnance earlier. They are the counterbalance to the feel-good hormones. You've got the feel-bad hormones, and they're both important. The secret is to get them balanced. How do you do that?
Just going to ask you that.
Well, you have to concentrate on all those activities in life which produce well-being. Now, part of that is positive. Do all the things you like doing. Part of it is negative. Remove the stressor. That's what fight or flight is about. What's a stress? People don't understand, generally speaking, in my experience, what we mean by stress. It's a perceived threat.
Yeah.
And it's perceived by sensory information coming into the brain, into the switchboard of the brain, if you like, the process of the thalamus, and sending it up to the cerebral hemispheres, where what we have learned in life tells us that this is a bad something happening to us, perceived threat. It could be an event. It could be a circumstance. It could be other people. It could be one person. But it's a perceived threat. Once that threat is perceived, the brain starts to do something about it. And we are immensely well protected against stress because the brain is all about survival. It's actually all about survival until the age of 40, when generally reproductive life falls off. Then after that, the brain didn't invest too much in aging. That's what happens. But the circumstances of our modern society has enabled us to live longer. So therefore, we do have to make sure that our well-being proceeds beyond that reproductive maturity. Now, there's good stress and bad stress. This is a relationship called the Yerkes-Dodson Law. Who were they? Well, Yerkes was a physician who turned to psychology in Harvard University. And Dodson was a psychologist in Minnesota. In fact, he was the first PhD in psychology in that university. They produced this curve, which was an inverted U. Imagine looking at the letter U turned upside down and stress along the bottom. So to a certain point, that stress will improve your performance. After that point, it will negatively affect your performance. So seek out the sweet spot. And everybody knows what their sweet spot is. Everybody knows how much they can take, or you should know. Now, what's that sweet spot? Well, for some people, and I'll give you two great examples, Luke Aitken and Alex Honnold. These are two Americans. And Luke Aitken, his idea of stress with which he could cope of jumping out of an airplane without a parachute. And I'm not joking.
Really?
Yeah, jumped out of an airplane without a parachute, yeah. And the other one is an American called Alex Honnold. It freaked me out reading about him. He climbed El Capitan in Yosemite, which is a overhanging 3,000 feet granite pinnacle in California, Yosemite National Park, with no rope.
No rope?
No, 3,000 feet high. No.
And it's an overhang?
It's an overhang, yeah.
Wow. And sorry, I just can't get this image of a guy jumping out of a plane with no parachute.
Oh, yeah, that was phenomenal. That was set up by a friend of mine who's a nutritionist in California. And he wanted to find out how much peak stress affected stress substances in the body. Mm-hmm. If he landed face down, he would have broken his back and killed him. So he had to flip. So he's going down, face down, no parachute, looking for the net. And this is on YouTube, and you can see Luke Aitken talking about, well, I was sitting there, and the light went on one minute to go, and the parachute was next to me. And then when it went to green, I just said, stuff it, and jumped out.
Well, that wasn't quite where I was expecting this interview to go. Well, such extremes, and just the thought of it is enough to stress me. Just as well, we can take a break now to hear from our sponsors. We'll be back after this.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio with me, JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and my guest, Professor James Goodwin, who had more to say on the subject of stress levels.
For other people, stress is just getting through the day. You've got to know where your stress point is. And if it's getting too much, listen to the body, fight or flight.
Yeah.
You've either got to do something about that stress or you've got to remove yourself from it. You can mitigate the stress. You can try and reduce the stress if you can't remove it. There are three big systems in the body which help you to deal with stress, one short term and two long term. Well, one's medium term. The short term one is basically the release of adrenaline. The medium one is your immune system, which starts to reduce inflammation in the body to deal with anything that could be going wrong. And the long term one is, it's actually called the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal system, HPA. That's long-term responses in the body. Long-term stress, that's what gets you. Long-term stress over days, weeks, months, years. That's what it's doing to the brain. Stress is driving these three systems. And I'll give you some examples. Lack of sleep. exposure to cold, pain, continuous and irritating noise, continuous and irritating people. All these things are a perceived threat, and they set off these three systems in the body, and they will inevitably affect the brain. The levels of inflammation on repeated stress will rise to the point where they're at their maximum. You're firing on all six cylinders and you're burning everything in the body to keep going. And then the system starts to collapse. That's called the general adaptation syndrome. It was first observed and called stress by Hans Selye. He's a Canadian, born in Vienna. He weighed the adrenal gland of rats when he stressed them out over a long period of time. And the adrenal gland grew and it was coping, and, you know, it was coping well with the stress. And then it stopped growing and it stayed the same. And then it started to shrink until it collapsed and couldn't work anymore.
Amazing.
Even a 1 degree decrease in temperature would kill those rats whose adrenal system collapsed. That's how insidious stress is.
The trick is to balance everything. You know, you say in your book, be positive, be active, be social, be purposeful. And that sounds like a balanced life to me. So I guess it's a question of balancing ourselves in such a way that the brain chemistry and our stress levels and our adrenaline levels are evened out.
I would say one of the big things for your listeners is you've got this work-life balance. It's a hackneyed expression. You know, you see people putting it at the bottom of their emails. I strive for a good work-life
balance. Yes. Yeah.
It's absolutely spot on. Who was it? Stephen Hawking said, never give up working. He didn't mean stay in your job forever. He meant have something to do.
Yeah, so it's just a question of really asking yourself or just paying attention to your own body and saying, is this stressing me out? You know, or what's happening here?
It is. I would take care to make sure that in downtime away from work that you did something purposeful. And certain activities we know are immensely valuable to the brain because they are stress reducers. Pets. They are the best stress busters ever. Another one is culture. I'm talking about art, literature, music. There's even a branch of science called neuroaesthetics. The guru of this is Professor Semi Ezeki in University College London, who has spent a lifetime studying the beneficial effects of art. Hugely beneficial to the brain. And certain parts of the brain, the blood flow increases by up to 10%, which is a lot. Just observing art and actually taking part in it.
Yeah,
now, I used to be a little bit sceptical about until I grew up and knew it and got to know better. Yoga, meditation and mindfulness. Our mindfulness, there's a part of the brain, it's actually quite a big part, called the default mode network. It calms the mind and it prevents the mind from wandering. You don't have to switch that on when you go to mindfulness. If your mind starts wandering and you start to get panic-stricken even, but too distracted, default mode network says, whoa, in the brain, it starts to release GABA and all those other things. Get you back down again and we get you to normal, right? But mindfulness, you know, it turns off this default mode network. You don't have to use it. It does the job for you. Meditation and yoga especially, right? Now, yoga, two things. One, it's proven it reduces anxiety, it reduces stress, it reduces the risk of depression, it improves mental health. But also, if you image the brain, those people who do yoga have got a completely different brain to you and I. I don't do yoga. Maybe I should. But we know that the brain structure is different. The areas of gray matter become denser, more gray cells are produced, and the white matter of the brain functions better. So those people who do yoga are actually delivering huge benefit to their intellectual and thinking skills, as well as making themselves feel better.
It is amazing. Well, I can testify to all of that as well, because these are all things that I've tried and they do work.
People have asked, can we use alcohol to mitigate stress? The answer to that is yes. Humans have used alcohol to reduce stress since written records began. There are some purists and some enthusiastic researchers who produced actually very good research to show that too much alcohol is disadvantageous to the brain. It's going to damage your brain health.
I was just going to ask you about that. Surely alcohol can cause damage, would you say it's irreparable?
Oh, well, drinking too much alcohol is a bad idea for your brain, for your liver, and if you're a man, for your testicles. If you're a young man and you're pickling your testicles on a regular basis, be prepared for sexual dysfunction when you get to middle age. They won't forgive you. The liver also is very, very unforgiving, and also is the brain. It will greatly affect you. Apart from anything else, it's hugely dehydrating, and the brain is little more than a bag of salty water, right? And the walls of which are, at their thickest, 5 millimetres. And that wall is the folded part of the brain with all the brain cells in it. You've really got to look after the brain. It's fragile and robust at the same time. You drag it out over many years of drinking what the Americans call strong liquor, right? Or we're talking about spirits, whiskey, vodka, gin, and so on. You drink large volumes of that persistently a long period of life. Your general health will suffer and your brain health will as well. But moderate drinking, there is evidence to show that moderate drinking is beneficial to the brain. Now, not all scientists want to hear this, and they'll dismiss the research and everything else. Well, let's go to the National Health Service guidelines. It's a general rule, one drink for a woman and two drink for a man. And that's not misogynist or sexist in any way. It's to do with physiology. And the two curves of effect between men and women overlap. So some women can tolerate two drinks a day, but the vast majority cannot. Why? There are a large number of physiological reasons. One is gastric alcohol dehydrogenase, an enzyme in the stomach, is missing in most women. So if a woman drinks a whiskey, all of it goes into the blood. If a man drinks a whiskey, only half of it.
Gosh, I didn't realise that.
Yeah. And sexist biology, I've heard people say about that. Oh, science isn't a narrative. You know, your listeners ought to realise this. Science is not somebody inventing a story, right, and then putting some facts to it. It doesn't work like that. It's empirical investigation. That's what it's all about. And actually comes down to maths, hypothesis testing. And maths is just about as objective as you can get. And also men have a bigger body mass, so they can absorb the alcohol in their tissues, especially their blood volume. The blood volume of many men is double that of women. So it requires men and women to know your limits, and actually you shouldn't disrespect this advice, two drinks or one. That's if you go beyond that, persistently go beyond that all of your life, then you're building up high risks to your health. That's what I would say. Going out and celebrating your birthday, JJ, and just, you know, coin a phrase, getting plastered once in a while. It's quite a short-term non-benefit, if you can put it that way. But if it's only once in a while, you know, an anniversary, a celebration, and your birthday, where you really get drunk beyond measure or have too much, that in the long term perspective of your life is not going to matter that much. It's if you overdo it every day. It's not the single things. It's the single things that you do every day that matter.
Yeah, and it's a long time since I've actually drunk alcohol. I stopped some years ago because my body wasn't tolerating it that well. So,
As I got older, I found that I tolerate alcohol less well.
Yeah.
You know, certain times you've got to have a drink. That's it. You know, you've got to have a drink. You've got to have one or several drinks, but not every day. I always drink water to keep my alcohol consumption at the level of 3%, which is a session beer. That's what we call it. If you're drinking whiskey, just drink the water to get it down to what the beer would be, 3%. You'll be fine then. I never drink two nights in a row, never. I'll say this to all your listeners. If you can't go for one day without a drink of alcohol, you have a problem. A small 6-ounce glass of wine, I suppose every day with a meal, it wouldn't be pushing it too much. But personally, I just say every other day.
Yeah. I don't even like alcohol anymore. I don't even like the way it makes me feel anymore, which is interesting. Yeah, and so I'm not tempted at all, ever. Yeah. But James, so fascinating, everything that that you're talking about here. And I say again, your book, Supercharge Your Brain, subtitled How to Maintain a Healthy Brain Throughout Your Life, is so fascinating, so well worth reading. I really do recommend it to everybody. There's everything that you've talked about and more in the book, and it's just a great source of information for anything that you might want to find out about whether your brain is being kept, in tip-top condition. And, you know,
can I finish with a story for you?
Yeah, you can. Yes, please do.
I was interviewed on an American radio station by Tristan Ahumada. The radio station has his program on there, which is called Brilliant Thoughts. And it was an hour and 20 minutes. And we covered just about everything we could think of. And we got on like a house on fire. We came to the conclusion, the ultimate brain health night out is a drink to start with, a date with someone you like, so you've got social activity there, an anti-stress meal, which we put together on the program, take the person home and spend the night with them, including a glass of wine when you've finished. Right, that is your ultimate brain health date.
Wow. Right. Well, that's, I'm sure that's given a few people a few ideas there. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with enjoying yourself. That's the other thing. Let's enjoy ourselves once in a while, right? Just having fun and having that interaction is so good for you.
You should try and feel good every day.
Yeah. About something or do something that makes you feel good every day. Yeah. Fantastic. James, thank you so much. Absolutely wonderful as ever. I'm hoping that you'll come back on the show again very soon and talk some more, because it's such a huge subject. Who knew? I know that the brain is complex, but who knew that brain health would be such a huge subject? So thank you so much again. And we'll hopefully hear from you again very soon. We'll definitely be hearing more from James Goodwin in the future. Right now, though, it's time for another break to hear from our sponsors. Back with my next guest, Coach Barbara Kerr, after this.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
You're listening to Alchemy 101, now still on the subject of stress, and back to those New Year's resolutions. If you're stressing yourself out trying to stick to yours, Edinburgh-based mind and body coach Barbara Kerr has some tips on how to keep your resolve and not stress out because you're finding it too hard to stay the course. I started our chat by asking, why all the stress anyway?
Well, if we even just look at between 42 and 92% of people actually fail to achieve their resolution, that creates more pressure, creates more stress for us. We're thinking that we've got to do something. And usually we do it in a negative way. I am not going to. That puts a lot of pressure on us.
It really does. You're right. It's that negative. Yeah. So tell us, talk a little bit more about that. I mean, if we're going to have resolutions, what might we do to ensure that we might possibly stick to them?
I think there's lots of things we can do. And one of them is move from like a fixed mindset into a growth mindset. So rather than thinking, this is what I'm going to do and here's my set intention and plan and it's going to happen, it's maybe break things down into small pieces, go for a growth mindset. I think this is going to take time. Things tend to be quite big. That's what we tend to do with resolutions. Like, right, 2023, I'm going to be more healthy. Well, what does that actually look like?
Yeah, what does it look like?
It was just like, I'm going to be more healthy. So what's that mean? I'm going to cut out all my sugar and I'm going to run every day. And these are really big things. Whereas if I maybe start to think of it in a way as such as like, I'm conscious of the impact that my decisions will have on my health. And looking at it that way, it's thinking, you know, I always say to people, look at your breakfast. What is that doing for you? Is that setting you up well? Or is that giving me a sugar hit because I've had the Cocoa Pops? It's going to make me crash and burn in a little while, not feel that good. What is it that I can do in small steps that can make me feel better?
Yes, it's important, isn't it, not to have that big picture in your head constantly. I mean, it's good to know where you want to be, but you're not going to get there immediately.
Absolutely. And one of the things I love doing when I'm working with people is that we will have a big picture, but it's like, well, how do we get there in those small steps? Because if I just say, do you know, I want to live abroad and I want this amazing house, and that's all fabulous, but how am I going to achieve that? So how can I get that?
Yeah, so people forget that it's not just going to fall in your lap. And sometimes it's a fast process and sometimes it's slow, but you don't get there without going through the process.
Absolutely. And it's in the process and in that growth mindset, thinking that way. So for an example, another one that we always usually come up with at New Year is, let's save money and spend less.
Yeah.
That's a big, huge thing. Break it down and say, well, you know, again, I realize that my financial health fuels my dreams. And if I say, instead of having that Starbucks every day on my way to work, I'm going to save that money and that's going to go towards my X, Y, or Z goal, that makes it manageable.
Yes, and remembering that actually the small amounts like a Starbucks or any other coffee, for that matter, all of those mount up. You know, look after the pennies and the pounds will look after themselves, as my mother used to say.
And we forget about that, but these things are true.
And it's not just true of money. I mean, it's true of everything. It's noticing the small things and making those small tweaks, small changes, and then they become incremental. And then suddenly you think, oh, look where I am. Look how I've succeeded.
Absolutely. People, again, other examples are somebody will say, oh, I want to learn a new skill this year. What does that mean? Whereas if I look upon and say, well, I want to sharpen my strengths and my skill set to do X, Y, and Z, it means I'm going to learn Spanish so that when I work abroad, I can communicate better. I've got a good reasoning behind it. It's practical. I can say, how am I going to do that? Well, I'm going to go on Duolingo for 10 minutes a day. It doesn't mean I have to go and spend hours sitting revising Spanish.
Yes, exactly. You don't have to go on an immersion course.
Things down to small steps, taking away the stress of thinking I have this big thing to do and I've got to find, you know, we know this is the 5 a.m. clubs. I've got to get up at 5 a.m. so I can meditate and write my journal and do my yoga. I think, you know, I'm stressed and I've not even got out of bed yet.
Yes, it's absolutely true. I was laughing at myself this morning because I didn't go for my morning swim this morning. And the reason was because I needed my sleep. And so I gave myself some leeway and said, OK, not this morning. You know, you've slept in, you've missed the boat. Tomorrow will be another day. And I think that's the other thing as well, is to give yourself some compassion. You have clients and you help people achieve what they want to achieve. So, you know, what kind of things are you telling people that they can do that might help them through this period, which can be quite stressful?
I always start on a 4-point basis. One, where are we? What's our lifestyle? Where's our mindset right now? How are we feeling? Secondly, keeping it simple, what are we eating? What's our nutrition doing? Because again, we're not sort of separated at the head and the neck down. What we eat impacts both how we think and likewise, vice versa. What we eat impacts our bodies. What are we exercising? What are we doing? Because again, the endorphins that kick off by going for a swim or going for a walk or doing a nice little bit of yoga or whatever it is that works for your body has a huge impact. And then the fourth one is sleep. How are we sleeping? So I like us to do a little bit of analysis of what's going on in all these aspects and how does that feed into everything, both in our personal and our professional development and growth. When we start breaking those down, we can start to see, we just make a little shift here. Is that going to make us feel better? Starting point is looking at what's going on in those four key things, our mindset, our nutrition, our fitness, and our sleeping patterns.
Yeah, I was just going to say, people tend to forget about the sleep, don't they? And, you know, that's why I didn't go for a swim this morning, because I just needed a bit more sleep.
Absolutely no, that sleep is crucial for so many things, even from dementia prevention down the line to less anxiety to better performance in the workplace, being better parents, being better young people for our parents.
Yeah.
And we all need it. And it's underrated.
It is underrated. And of course, a lot of people have a problem with sleep. I'm sure you've probably got a couple of tips for that.
Absolutely. We have sort of what we call the sleep hygiene checklist. And it's, what are people's nighttime routines? What are their morning routines? Because it's all connected. You know, what do you do? Are you sitting on your phone late at night? I'm not talking about you personally, obviously, but as in what does it mean? Are you sort of going for a nice bath and having a cup of chamomile tea? Are we switching off from all the problems of the day? Or are we lying in bed thinking about things? How about reading and just agree to yourself that every night I'm going to read 4 pages of my book so that I'm in a different world. I'm not taking to bed my current thoughts. or, you know, and certainly in young people, we see a lot of it where, you know, they do carry through things in the day. They lie there and they think about it. It's like, right, how about writing that down? Just popping it out of your head, putting it into a journal and saying, there, I'm done. Half an hour before you go to sleep. Social media is such a problem for young people. They spend so many hours. And then, of course, we've got that whole comparison issue. Everybody else is having a better time than I am, and I'm about to go to sleep.
Yeah. But I tell you, one of the reasons why I did sleep in this morning was because I didn't get to bed till quite late last night. And that's because I was wrangling with computer issues and I needed to get them sorted out. And I didn't want to leave them until the morning. So by the time you've left your computer alone, you've turned your phone off, you're still not quite in that space for sleeping. And so I didn't actually get any decent sleep until quite late. What I did do is make up for it in the morning. And I think, you know, we need to allow ourselves to do these things.
That's it. And sometimes being too rigid with ourselves and our patterns and actually slow. See, what's coming up for me right now? How do I feel? So if I've had a night like you had where I thought, oh, I've had to work later and it's all in my head, I said, well, I'm going to go to bed an hour later. I'm going to let myself have the permission to have an hour's relaxation, go to bed and get up an hour later.
Yeah. So it is about just paying attention to what's going on with your own body and also, you know, being a bit sensible about things. And what other things do you think that people might benefit from hearing?
From the nighttime perspective, then definitely things like how much fluid are you drinking in the evening? So a lot of people get broken sleep because they need to get up and go to the toilet.
Mm-hmm.
It's not talked about very often. A lot of people sort of say, doesn't everybody get up in the night? Well, actually, no.
No, they don't.
It'd be an issue here.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, if you get up more than once. So what do you suggest people might do?
So I think make sure you're really hydrated during the day so that there comes an evening point where you say, that's me done. There's no more liquid. Okay. Relaxation. So again, as I say, read a book, go for a bath, even just going for a nice sort of little calm time, watching 10 minutes of a favourite comedy programme, something that's joyful, not sitting watching Question Time or the news or anything, trying to change that mindset, but thinking about nice things to be doing.
Yeah. So you are actually physically relaxing. Exactly.
Absolutely. A little bit of one of my favourite tools is a foam roller. And honestly, if I worked in the NHS, I would prescribe that everybody has a foam roller and a big long one. Most people have short ones.
Mm-hmm.
A big long one that you can lie your body and you can have it down the side of your bed. And it just gets your posture open. It opens up across the front of the chest, your shoulders relax. So the whole posture gets relaxed. And breathing. Breathing is another absolute key of an evening, especially if you're prone to anxiety. Being able to say, right, I can breathe my way so I can reduce my heart rate, get myself feeling nice and calm. And there's lots of different breathing. One of my favourites, the 4-4 square, because I can't think about anything else. And I've got count to four. So you breathe in for four as you count. You hold for four as you count. You breathe out for four as you count. And again, you hold for four. So while you're thinking and doing, nothing else can really pop into your head.
Yeah, yeah.
So between that breath, lying on a foam roller, letting the body relax, and thoughts will pop in. If you're just lying on a roller, you know, it's a bit like a meditative state, and thoughts will pop in, but there's nothing wrong with that. Acknowledging them and say, thank you, that's for another day.
Yeah.
And again, there's processes that people use, and it's, you know, everything is dependent on the person. As I always say, there's no one size fits all, but there's ways for everybody that you will find the right one for you. That's what I talk a lot about, is sort of like motivation, why we want to sleep better or why we want to feel better, our inspirations, what's going to help us on that journey, and finding those solutions so that we then go, right, that's the one that works for me. And as my dad used to say, there's a lot of suck it and see. Did that work? Did it not?
Yeah, yeah. Yes, exactly. It's too easy to compare yourself to other people and say, oh, you know, they're doing that, I should be doing that. No, not necessarily. Might not work for you.
And it's lovely hearing all the things that other people do and saying, oh, that might work for me. But then if it doesn't, it's not like you say, well, what's wrong with me?
Yes.
Or look at something else that other people are doing, think, well, why don't I enjoy that? And it's my favourite line. I heard it years ago, and it's like, comparison is a thief of joy.
Well, that's a nice one. Yeah, I like that.
So true. If we're looking at what everyone else is doing, then we're not happy with what we're doing. And again, that comes down to our happiness and our fulfillment, which is a whole other conversation in terms of how we get those things.
Yeah.
But part of that is our balance in those four key things, our mindset, our nutrition, our fitness, and our sleep patterns.
Yeah, absolutely. And at the risk of boring listeners to this show, I bring it back to the swimming again, because a lot of people who are starting say, well, you know, they'll say, well, how long do you stay in the water? And you think, I actually don't time myself anymore. I just listen to my body. And when it's time to get out, I get out. You can't compare. You know, you've got a different body. You've got a different tolerance. You've maybe not been doing it for that long. Do not compare. And it doesn't matter what anybody says or thinks. And it's so hard for people to get that.
But it's so true. And, you know, I do that. Running is my thing. And I work with a lot of people in running. And people say, I can't run. And I'll say, well, actually, everybody can run, because, you know, unless you've got a real injury or a problem, then, you know, most people can move their feet just a little bit faster than a walking pace. So it doesn't matter whether it's like, you know, the speed, it's actually that physical movement. But as long as you get the breath right, then you can do it. And it's very similar in the cold water swimming. Now, I will say right here now, I take my hat off to you. I am not, my heart doesn't like the cold water.
Mm.
I've done it. And again, I've trained myself. I can go in and do the breath, but mm-hmm. I know that I am a warm water fan.
Yeah.
It's in the same way as in the, you know, again, you train yourself, and I don't compare. I don't look and say, oh, do you know, I wish I could go and do that. I'd like the experience, but I know it doesn't work for me.
Exactly.
And running, I like doing slow and steady distance. I'm not a sprinter. So it's about what works for us.
Correct. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. And running doesn't work for me. Walking,
mm-hmm.
I'll walk anywhere. No problem at all, but don't ask me to run anywhere or do it, you know, go jogging. I think that would make me a bit stressed. So it's not comparing yourself to people. It's doing things in bite-sized chunks and not getting yourself worked up about not reaching your goals, which are whatever goals there are, but being specific about your goals, knowing exactly what it is that you want.
And I mean, there's some simple, a lot of people will have heard of even just like the SMART system. So it's very specific, it's measurable, it's achievable, realistic, and it's time-framed. So that if you break it down into those little chunks, it's not me saying, right, you know, I'm going to start and I'm going to start 2023 and I'm going to run every day. Well, that's not going to happen, because your body is likely to say this is a wee bit sore on day three if you've not done it before. So it's about saying, well, why don't I just start with a 5-minute walk and then I'll do 20 little steps that are just a bit faster.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you could put that into going into the sea and saying, well, I'm just going to have a nice little bit of walk on the seafront and then do 5 steps into the water. And then we build up 25 or 7 or, you know, building these small things. And they're also trying to say it might not happen perfectly. Doesn't necessarily go the way we think it will. There will be hurdles that will come in. But that doesn't mean we stop and get off track. It means we say, okay, today it didn't work the way I thought it was going to do. How can I make sure that tomorrow I've got the motivation to get back and do it again, not go, oh, I failed.
Indeed, indeed. Now, Barbara, I know that you run workshops, and I don't know if you've got anything coming up this coming year, but people can probably find out all about those workshops and all about you and, you know, get some more information at your website, can't they?
Absolutely. It is www.transformbodyandmind.co.uk.
Fantastic. And do you have workshops coming up? I mean, and is this the kind of thing that you go through? You also do sort of, you know, body workshops as well, don't you?
I do. We have retreats that we do. So we've got ones in Scotland. We have overseas in the Canary Islands. We have workshops on all different kinds of things, from revitalizing our eating to mindset workshops. There's courses that we do throughout the year, sort of on Be the Best You, which is helping look at all those aspects of our life. And there's sort of 8 pillars that we talk about. So those happen throughout the year. They're all there on the website. And as always, my biggest thing is, anyone's interested, just give us a shout, because there's no one size fits all. And we do a lot of bespoke work to help people for their specific issues.
That is fantastic. Yeah, no, it's great. And you do some of your retreats in beautiful places as well. Thank you so much for coming on the show and for talking us through some of the things that we could do at this time of year to stop us getting so stressed and worked up about our start to the year. And yeah, hopefully people will have got a little nugget or two out of our conversation here. And if they want to learn more from you, they can get in touch and drop you a line at your website.
That would be lovely. And it's been so nice chatting with you. Thank you.
Barbara Kerr there. Her website again, transformbodyandmind.co.uk. And with that, we're near the end of the show. Remember, we're on the world's favourite podcast channels now too. And if you're listening to the podcast and you like what you hear, do subscribe and share this episode. And it would be amazing if you could leave a review too. You can download this show from the Alchemy 101 page at ukhealthradio.com, and why not check out our sister publication, Health Triangle Magazine, while you're on the website too. For now, though, it's goodbye from me and that nightingale until next time on Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio.